When I saw what my topic was this morning, you're not going to believe this, but it reminded me of the dinner table conversations we used to have when I was a kid growing up. And my father was a lawyer, and he would hold court, more or less, at the dinner table. And he would, I think, in an effort to get us all to become lawyers, he would pose these possibilities, and then we would debate them. And just to give you an idea, one of his favorites was the futility of effort. And he would say, it is futile to put out this energy, and then we would go back, but no, Dad, that can't be, and back and forth. It would get very heated. And we would run to the library, and we'd bring down books and get our references and our sources. And my mother, this particular night, saw that it was getting a little heated, and she said, look, she said, for a guy who puts out so much energy to support your 9 children, it's ridiculous for you to argue about the futility of effort. And she said, case dismissed. So that was, you know, part of the growing up. And one of the topics that came up at our dinner table conversations, not just once, but many times, was whether or not there was an absolute good. And what was the relationship between the absolute and the relative? And so we argued that one over and over again. And it kept coming up because we never really got it. And I didn't really get it. I wish that I had known Swami Kriyananda then, because I wouldn't have won a lot of cases. But Swami explained it so beautifully that only realized masters who have known God can explain God. And what they say is that he belongs to that absolute reality. And that in relationship to that absolute reality is the relative reality in which we find the satanic force. And that kind of explains everything, really, except that it doesn't. Because we have to deal with it on so many, many levels. And yet, I think we all come in, the product of many past incarnations, with this understanding that there are these opposing forces in the world that we have to sort out and come up against. And because I work with children, as one of the teachers and the director of the school, and Gary works there as well, I come up against a child's understanding of the power of evil and the force of evil over and over again. It reminds me, or maybe it's appropriate at this point, to share with you a little story. I've told it before, but not for a really long time, about my own daughter, Maria, who was, when she was 3 years old, mesmerized by the story of the big bad wolf and the 3 little pigs. And if you're part of this culture, you've probably not escaped that from Disneyland, but briefly, you have these 3 little pigs, and they, 2 of the pigs want to play all the time, and the 3rd pig is very conscientious. And so they need to build houses for shelter, and the 1st little pig builds a straw house. He throws it together, and then he goes out and he plays on his fiddle. And the 2nd little pig builds a house of sticks. Not really that great, but, you know, it took a little more effort, and then he runs out and begins to play. But the 3rd little pig, he builds a house of bricks. And that he gets the bricks and he gets the mortar and he's very carefully putting them all together and making sure it's stout and sturdy. And he has a great little house. Well, in the neighborhood was the wolf. And the wolf was hungry. And the wolf went out looking for his next meal. And he came across the 1st little pig, and that little pig saw the wolf and went, wow, I'm in trouble. And he ran into his little house. But the wolf just huffed and puffed and blew it down. And that little pig ran over to the house of sticks and said, brother, let me in. And he did. And then the wolf came to that house. And he huffed and he puffed and he blew that house down. And the 2 little pigs, terrified, ran to the 3rd little pig's house and said, brother, let us in. And that little pig let them in. And they felt safe because they were in this house of bricks that was so sturdy. And the wolf came. And now you can see this 3-year-old listening to this. And the wolf came and he huffed and he puffed and he huffed and he puffed. And he couldn't get that house down because that little pig had put out all this good energy. But the wolf was wily. Satan is wily. And he thought, I'm just going to climb on the roof and go down the chimney. But the three little pigs were in there. The two were shivering and shaking with terror. The third little pig was a can-do person. He was always looking for solutions. He was always putting out energy. And he says, I'm going to boil a big pot of water in the fireplace. And so he did, and the wolf came down, and you all know the end of the story. The good guys won, right? So one night, Maria, 3 years old, it's bedtime, and I'm trying to put her down, and she says to me, Mommy, I want you to read me the story of the three little pigs. And I said, oh, I don't think that's a good idea. It's bedtime. Because I don't know if you remember in your childhood, but I was traumatized by the Wicked Witch of the West in The Wizard of Oz for a year or more. And I always saw the shadow from the street lamp outside projected on the wall as a great big huge bear that might come and get me. I mean, these are vivid images that I hold today. And I thought, no three little pigs tonight. But she said, no, really, I promise I'll go to sleep. I said, okay. So I read the story. And at the end of it, she very thoughtfully turned to me and she said, Mommy, where does that wolf live? And I thought about that. And I said, well, he lives in the book. Does he ever get out? No. He never gets out. He stays in the book. And she went to sleep. And all was well. And then she turned four. And that summer, we went to Disneyland. And we had such a good time at Disneyland. We did this ride and that ride and this ride and that ride. We were standing there kind of in a little interim space. And all of a sudden, she goes, Mom! With terror in her voice. Look! And I looked over and there was a 6 foot tall, big bad wolf. With the great big snout and the big furry tail and the overalls that were right correctly as in the book. And he was signing autographs. And his back was turned to us. But she was literally terrified. And she ran around me and put her arms around my legs in a death grip. And I'm thinking, how am I going to recover my credibility here? When all of a sudden, I didn't even see this coming. She ran out, raced over to the big bad wolf, whose back was still turned to us, and hauled off with her leg and kicked him in the seat of the pants as hard as she could. And then, realizing that he could turn around, she raced back and hid behind me. So I actually was very proud of her. I mean, it was perhaps the first act of moral courage that she ever had. You know, she recognized in her child's way the presence of evil. This guy had taken out after those little pigs that she was fond of, and he did wrong, and he needed to be taught, and he needed to be answered, and she answered him. And I thought, this is good. This is good. I could see that the character inside of her was building enough so that she could, in the moment, overcome that deep-seated fear that made her tremble at the thought of that big bad wolf. And I don't think that she's alone in that, that when we come up against negative energies, the first reaction is fear. Right? And then the only question remains, well, what are we going to do about that fear? What are we going to do with our energy to combat that fear? And are we going to do something that is productive? And in school, we come up against the question of good and evil every single year in a very spectacular way, because we put on a play every single year about the life of a great soul. And in the life of a great soul, because they are exuding so much good energy, they actually require a response from dark energy. And they get it. The story of Jesus is dramatic. He was preaching a gospel of love. And the satanic energies came back. And it did not have, at a certain point, what seemed like a very happy ending. And then you get beyond that and you see the transcendence. This year we did Joan of Arc. And that's a tough one. Because Joan was a little French village girl who listened to the voices of God, who came to her through the angels. And she was directed to lead the French army against the English, who were threatening to take over the country. And she did. And she had such magnetism because in listening to her inner voices and to the voice of God and aligning her energy with that divine energy, she was able, unbelievably, incredibly, to convince the powers that be, the king and everybody else, that she should do it. And so she did. But in the end, the powers of darkness came back at her, and she was condemned to death by the Inquisition. Death by burning at the stake. Now, these are children. And every time we have this discussion in the faculty meetings, how are we going to deal with those dark forces in these plays? And we always come down to the same answer. They're children, but they're souls. They're eternal beings. And they have within them this deep wisdom, and potentially we bring it out. And we can do so sensitively. This year, I'll give you a little preview, we're going to do George Washington Carver. And George Washington Carver doesn't have the dramatic life in a way. There aren't any great battle scenes. If you know, he was born a slave at the end of the Civil War, and he went through Reconstruction in the South, and actually is responsible for saving the South from starvation because he was a mystic scientist. And he brought in the concept of biodynamic gardening. Gary wrote the script. And organic gardening. And the land had been depleted by all the cotton that had been grown over and over again, never giving anything back to the soil. So, yes, it's a great story. But in that story, because he's in the South, we have the Deep South, we have all those terrible things that were happening. We have lynchings. And how do you deal with that with little children? And so again, the faculty debated it. Well, do we? Don't we? You know, how? And now you'll have to come to see what we do. But we're going to be true. We're going to be authentic. Because this life, in this life, as little children, if we are very clear about the fact that evil does exist, there is a satanic force, then foreknowledge is to the good. Because then we know we have to keep our energy up. We have to be on the alert. We always have to be open-hearted, aligned with the forces of good. Now notice in the story of Maria, when after she had done her big gesture against the wolf, what did she do? She didn't say, nanny, nanny, nanny. She ran back to her mother. And I think about that as symbolic of what we always need to do when we come up against anything that has a tinge of darkness to it. We put out our energy, we use what we have, and we ask for the protection of Divine Mother. And she is always there, always waiting to help us. Now, evil just doesn't exist on the great battlefields and in the great epics or even in the epic fairy tales. It also exists in the mundane. And that's where it can be really dangerous. Because here we are, we're in Silicon Valley. We don't have bombs dropping on us. We're not the victims of genocide. Life here is pretty sane, in a way. In a way. The challenges are different. And they exist in that world of those desires which fall along the line of the more mundane desires that take us away from our true journey in this lifetime. I'm reminded of the story of the 10 virgins in the New Testament. And Jesus, it's a parable. And Jesus tells the story that there were 10 virgins. 5 were wise, 5 were foolish. And their mission was to await the bridegroom, obviously the symbol for the Lord, for Jesus, for God, for Divine Mother. And they were to await with oil lamps lit in honor of this very, very deeply meaningful experience. God was coming. So five of them showed up and they had their oil lamp and they had some reserve oil. They thought ahead. And the other five showed up and they only had their lamps. And there wasn't a lot of oil in those lamps. And so they waited and the bridegroom didn't come and it got later and later and no bridegroom. And the five who had no oil left, their lamps went out. What to do? So they turned to the other five and they said, "Will you share your oil with me, just a little?" And the other said, "But if we do that, then we won't have enough if he's really, really late." And so they had to go off and find more oil. And of course, while they were gone, what happened? He showed up. And the five wise virgins were able to walk through the door with him. And the others were too late. They missed their opportunity. It was such a little thing. And I thought, you know, a little oil, a little extra oil on a backpacking trip. What happens when you forget the matches? You know? Or I was sharing with the other ministers in the minister's room. I read about the opening of Levi Stadium and the crowds going, and the first time, lots of little glitches. But one of the little glitches that stood out for me was that some of the women, the foolish virgins, forgot to read the fact that they couldn't bring big purses in, and they all showed up with their big purses. And that kind of qualified the whole experience for them. Long times having to give things up and long times having to wait to get them bad. So the mundane, one of the most mundane things that Swami warns us about, especially when you're talking about children with teenagers, but for anybody, for myself, for you, is the possibility of moods to drag us down into the darkness, to qualify whatever good energy we have, to just suck it up because we give in to moods caused by whatever negativity there is in our life. For me, my battlefield often is El Camino Real in the morning when I'm trying to come to school and get here on time, and some idiot, you know, somebody on their phone, they cut you off, they don't use their blinkers, whatever it is, and it just, you know, I can feel my tension rising and I might have a few words to say about them. And then I have to catch myself and I have to say, no. You don't know what their reality is. The other day I was out there and this woman in a great big SUV was totally mindless and she did all these things and I was just thinking bad things about her. And then I thought, wait a second, Helen, she's on her phone. She probably had to leave the kids at home. Somebody's sick. The nanny is new. She's not sure she's going to take care. And I created this whole scenario just to open my heart to accept the fact that, what do I know? You know? And why should I expend my energy judging or feeling bad about something that's going to be over like that? You know? So moods, when they do get big, then we have to look at it another way. Because as Swami said, as we get older, and I can tell you this is true, as we get older, the tests seem to get bigger. I'm sorry for all of you who are very young, but I do believe that that's true. And I also understand in my heart of hearts that that is one of the biggest gifts that God gives us. Because the way I imagine it is that we, each one of us, have this cheering section up there in heaven. And it's Divine Mother. You know those mothers who go to the games that their children play? And their fathers. And it's all the saints and all the angels. And it's especially if you have a saint's name, it's your namesake saint. And so I've got this all figured out in my mind when I have these tests. Because when you have a test, one of the things that I believe is satanic is to believe that you're actually facing it by yourself, when in fact we are never alone. God is always with us. And it's just a question of, can we feel that? Can we acknowledge that in our heart of hearts? that there's another set of footprints walking along the sand. So I imagine that with the big tests. And I also, Shanti told me a story that she'd heard from Bharat, and it's something that I do, and I think it's worth doing. Whenever I get a huge test, I think of it as, I visualize it as coming directly from God to me, wrapped up in a custom, beautiful package. Bharat used the image of Divine Mother approaching us, dressed in flowing robes. I imagine it blue and white, with astral gems, holding a golden bowl. And in the bowl, our test. And offering it to us, and saying, this is from me to you. Because when we do the opposite, when we look at tests as the enemy, and we straight arm them, and we say, that's not mine, there must be some mistake, then we are not taking advantage of one more opportunity to move forward on our journey home. We're all going on this journey back to God from whence we came. We all came from original goodness, not original sin. You know, in my readings, when I have to give a Sunday service, if you had come to my house the last couple of days, you would have seen books all over the place. Not that it helps me, because the only really good book or books that I have are Swamiji and Master, and you know. But I had been reading this book about the Greek Orthodox Church, just for fun, and I came across this very interesting point, which meant a lot to me when I read it. There is a word called metanoia. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, but metanoia in the Greek means the transformation of the heart. Now, what was interesting is that early on, when the Gospels were first being printed, written down, they were translated into Greek. And then from the Greek, they came to us, to English. And the translators translated the word metanoia as penitence and repentance, not transformation of the heart. And as a result, if you read the Gospels, there's this whole stream of themes that go through it around the notion of penitence and asking for forgiveness. And I looked at that and I thought, oh, you know, I grew up in this large Catholic family. And that was part of my reality, that idea that we really are sinners and that we have to do penance and we have to ask for God's forgiveness. Now, in one sense, there's nothing wrong with that. But the truth is, God has already forgiven us. There's nothing to forgive. He's just our cheering section. He's just waiting for us to come to him. He's not looking at what's keeping us back. He's holding out for us where we have to go. And I thought, that makes so much better sense to me when it comes to walking step by step on this path back to God. Because when we go through our trials and our tribulations, and we all have them, if we do it in the right way, what we achieve is a purification of the heart in the first place. And when our hearts are purified a little bit more, or a whole lot more, doesn't matter, it's progress. But when our hearts are purified, that leads to greater illumination, understanding. And illumination also suggests the lighting up of the person, the soul. And with purification and illumination, that brings us to a transformation of heart. And of course, that's exactly what Satan doesn't want. But of course, that's exactly where we need to be headed. That transformation of heart, where, as in the chant that you sang earlier this morning, sometimes I have to sing them, but you wouldn't want to hear me sing it. Desire, my great enemy, with his soldiers surrounded me. is giving me lots of trouble. That's the first part of the story. But the second part of the story is, what are the words? That enemy I will deceive. We should sing it. That enemy I will deceive, remaining in the castle of peace. Night and day in thy joy, Lord. Night and day in thy joy. And we'll come full circle. When my father was dying, he was surrounded by all of his children. He was awake. He was conscious. He was looking at me with those great blue eyes. And in my heart of hearts, I was singing that chant. In day and night, in that joy, Lord. Day and night, in that joy. And I watched the light go out of his eyes, and I knew that he was in that joy. He had fought the good fight for this time. And with that, I think we all can join together, being each other's cheering sections, being each other's partners as we walk through, always inviting Divine Mother, because truly the battle will be won. It is just a question of when.